This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michaela Cole, is the creator, writer, director, and star of the new HBO series, I May Destroy You. The show is leading to a lot of conversation because it's about a subject that can be hard to talk about, rape, as well as forms of sexual assault that the victim may not even realize is assault. I May Destroy You is a stylish, sometimes funny drama starring Cole as Arabella, a young writer whose first book, Chronicles of a Fed-Up Millennial, was published online. It made her famous on social media, but now she's trying to complete a draft for her second book. She takes a break one night, goes for a drink with a friend, and later regains consciousness with no memory of what happened. She figures out her drink was spiked. She has unsettling images in her mind that she can't shake of a man above her. She doesn't know if the man in this image is the man who raped her, and she's kind of in denial that she was raped. As the series goes on, she tries to cope with the assault's profound effects on her life while also trying to meet her publishing deadlines. Michaela Cole was assaulted in a similar way when she was writing and starring in her first TV series, Chewing Gum. That was a comedy about a naive 24-year-old in East London desperately trying to lose her virginity. Cole also starred in the Netflix series Black Earth Rising, playing a young woman saved from the Rwandan genocide. Cole's parents are from Ghana. Before we start my interview with Michaela Cole, I want you to know that part of our discussion will be about sexual assault, but nothing explicit. Nevertheless, some listeners may find that part of the discussion too disturbing. Let's start with a clip from I May Destroy You. The young writer, Arabella, suspecting she's been raped, goes to the police station to report it. She tries to answer the policewoman's questions, but still isn't sure what the flashbacks of the man on top of her mean. She's not sure they're actually a memory. She calls these flashing images the thing in my head. Here's Michaela Cole as Arabella, and Sarah Niles as the police officer who speaks first.
And the assault, you recall?
The thing in my head?
Yes.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Because now you're calling it something that I never said that.
Do you see anyone else?
Where?
In this memory.
No, you can't call it a memory.
Okay, other than the man in the...
In my head. It may not even be real because I'm the person that can actually see it and I'm not sure, so we should... Probably pay attention to that.
Yes.
Yeah, because we don't know. That's a very big thing to assume. I'm just saying that we should refrain from talking about things like that, facts, and we should probably just be careful.
Okay.
Michaela Cole spoke to us from her home in London. Michaela Cole, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the series. Before we really get into things, like, how are you? How are you doing during the pandemic? I haven't been following closely how things are in London. So are you basically just staying home?
Yes. First of all, hi, Terry. It's really lovely to talk with you. Thank you for having me on. I'm taking it day by day. It's we're not too far behind America. I think we're the third in terms of how big the impact has been and how much it's spread here. It's an adjustment, but my mum is actually a nurse on the front lines, and I try to look to how she behaves to guide how I behave, and she's really in very good spirits and quite excited that she's able to contribute to tackling the problem. So, and she's very grateful and happy, so I just keep looking to my mom instead of becoming very anxious. Yes.
So let's get to it. Why did you want to write a series where rape and various forms of sexual assault are at the center of the story?
I think in the beginning, I wanted to write about it because it had happened, and I have a habit of writing some sort of piece that's inspired by reality, whether it's poetry or music or a one-woman play or a TV show. And because I found it so huge in my life, it seemed only natural for me to write it. But as I began thinking about doing this, other people started sharing their stories with me, friends, friends of friends, and I realized that many people had some sort of experience that was connected to mine involving consent, and there were so many different ways to explore consent and how it affects us today. So what better basis for a story than one that I felt many people could find an identification in?
You know, in the story, Arabella is given a roofie, her drink is spiked, and she doesn't know what happened. She doesn't know how it happened or who did it or who may have witnessed it. And she doesn't even know if it really happened, or maybe doesn't want to accept the fact that it really happened. Was it traumatic for you to write about this and to act the part? For some people, I think it might have brought on kind of PTSD.
Yes, especially writing it. Did it bring on PTSD? I was probably already suffering from PTSD anyway. It was really interesting because it almost sent me around the bend back into the shock. It suddenly felt very new. It still startled me that it had happened. So writing it definitely made the event feel very present again. Performing it, I just loved. I really love to perform. You know, I love that act because there is a team of people there. We had a therapist that was on site at all times. So it felt like I could be safe to explore very dangerous areas in a very safe playground.
So I want to ask you if it's okay if I talk with you about your own experience, and you could guide me with what you're comfortable talking about and what you're not, because I don't want to cross any boundaries here. So can I ask a little bit about your own experience and how it led to the series?
Yes, let's try.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So did you experience the same kind of thing that Arabella does, where you had a drink that was spiked, where you were given a roofie and basically lost consciousness and didn't know what happened?
Yes.
How did you piece together what had happened? Like, did you have friends who could help you? Did you have a similar kind of image in your head of somebody, you know, being over you or on top of you and not knowing who it was or what it meant?
Yes, in many ways, Arabella's story at that point in the series is very similar to mine, but there are differences that I've intentionally kept so that there's always a distinction between myself and Arabella. But yes, I was writing an all-nighter at a production office that I was making a TV show for, and went on a break to meet my friend in a bar, and I had a drink, and then I was back at work typing and finishing the episode that was due, and didn't quite realize, you know, my phone was smashed, I was a mess, but it didn't quite connect the dots until I had a flashback. And then yes, I had friends who helped me going through Uber receipts, bank statements, calling other friends to literally try and gather the pieces. So our stories are different, but there are many, many similarities.
So let me play a clip. And this is the first time that Arabella sees her therapist. And she still is not even close to having processed what happened to her. So here's the therapist asking the first question. This is about 2 months after the rape.
How are you doing?
I'm great, great. I'm great as long as I'm around people. When I'm alone.
Flashbacks?
It's just sometimes it gets a bit much.
Mm. What do you do when it gets a bit much?
I just make sure I'm around someone, anyone. And if I'm not, I say, there are hungry children, there are hungry children, there are hungry children. There's a war in Syria, there's a war in Syria, there's a war in Syria. Or not everyone has a smartphone, not everyone has a smartphone, not everyone has a smartphone. To remind myself of the bigger picture.
Sometimes, when we try our best to see the big picture, we lose sight of the little one altogether. The little detail here is you.
So that's a scene from I May Destroy You, and my guest, Michaela Cole, is the creator, writer, director, and star. You know, I think the therapist's advice is so interesting. I think both ends of that are so interesting, with Arabella trying to convince herself, okay, maybe I was raped, but like, there's worse things in the world. Like, there's war, there's famine. It's like, I'm fine. And the therapist saying, you're losing yourself if you're just looking at the big picture. You're not seeing, you're not honoring what happened to you. I just think that's a very interesting insight. I'm wondering if that's an insight you came to on your own or through therapy.
Oh, well, I wonder, I really don't know how I came to that, whether that was my incredible therapist or whether that was my, you know, I definitely look at myself and my tendency to look out instead of looking in. And sometimes looking out is almost an escape from looking in. So, yes, there are hungry children. There is a war in Syria. Not everybody does have a smartphone. And within this world, you were raped rather than I was raped. But there's people don't have smartphones. It's and. And if you're using the outside world to escape your own introspection, I think that's where Arabella goes wrong and where I've definitely gone wrong in my life.
Can I ask if you ever found out who raped you? You can tell me no.
No, I don't think I need to tell you no. I was just thinking about it. I didn't. Just like the majority of women in the world whose drinks are spiked by strangers, I didn't know.
My guest is Michaela Cole. Let's talk about your life. Describe where you grew up in London.
I grew up in Tower Hamlets, a borough, a neighbouring city of London, on a housing association council estate. So it's a building that sits in a place and homes, maybe something like 300 different homes. I'm not sure the number around that. But outside of that, it's just the Royal Bank of Scotland, the London Stock Exchange is there. So it's not a neighborhood or a residential area. It's just a building where it's part funded by the government to live there. So it's for people who are below a certain economic threshold.
So I know your parents were from Ghana. Your mother raised you. I think your parents separated before you were born. So were there other children who had parents who were immigrants from countries in Africa? Did you have people your age who you could talk to who had similar backgrounds?
Yeah, definitely. And I also had my sister. She was 2.5 years older than me. So there was something also quite lovely about being in a house with three women. It meant that we were quite free. We didn't have to, you know, moderate the things we wore necessarily or anything like that, because there was no man in the house. So there's something quite freeing about that. And when I went to high school, it was lovely to meet other people who were also children of immigrants who looked like me. And it's really very nice to see yourself reflected in that way.
So my understanding of the story is that you had joined a dance group, and it turned out that the group was affiliated with the Pentecostal church, and you ended up being born again and being a member of the church. When you were in your late teens and a member of the church, what did you find most attractive about being a part of it?
Definitely, I would say the sense of something beyond, discovering something outside of yourself, and the community of people that all believed in this same thing, that named the thing beyond us the same name.
You went to Catholic school. Can you compare the sense of religion you got from Catholic school to the sense that you got from being a member of the Pentecostal church?
Oh, I wouldn't say there was any religion involved in the Catholic school I went to.
Okay.
No, no.
But you were taught by nuns, probably, right?
I really don't know why it's a Catholic school. It's a Catholic school, but no, you're just taught by teachers who are not nuns. They're just teachers from everywhere. I don't know where the nuns are. Perhaps they're on vacation for the 5 years I was there, and their stand-ins were absolutely dreadful.
So when you were in the Pentecostal church, did you speak in tongues?
I did. I first spoke in tongues in a park. We would do this thing called prayer in the park. And one of those prayer days, that was when I first spoke in tongues.
Can you explain what it's like to speak in tongues? And like, did you feel like you were inspired to do it by the divine spirit, and that it was just kind of coming out of you unprovoked? Or did you try to figure out what to say? Or like, how did that work for you?
Yes, I know. I think it did come out of me unprovoked. And I was definitely having an experience of something beyond. And I liken that very much to the writing process, when I don't necessarily know what I'm going to write, but I put my fingers on the keypad and something flows. It's also like improvising as a comedy group in English. This just happens to be tongues, and it's unexplainable, but yet it does happen.
And what was the experience of doing it? How did that feel? Did it make you feel more connected spiritually to other people in the church?
You know, no, I just remember being very emotional, very, very, very emotional. And then, you know, life carries on as normal. And I think I even got some congratulations. Welcome, tongue speaker. You have spoken in tongues. And it would, you know, sometimes I'd be in church and I'd speak in tongues again. Yes, I mean, obviously, I definitely don't speak in tongues anymore. But I, you know, when I meditate, sometimes I cry. Hey, I'm sure if I wanted to speak in tongues, which is just like sound, of course, I think we all could if we tried.
I think the church probably had a kind of set of approved and restricted behaviors. I'm wondering, like, when you left the church, if you kind of headed in the opposite direction when the restrictions were lifted.
Interesting. Yes, definitely. But I don't know whether that was because of the church. The church always really did give me permission to be me. I've always been, you know, I think people might describe me as a little bit, how would they describe me? I've been described as gratifyingly bonkers. And the church, the church definitely did not try and dampen that in any way. They loved it. They loved me performing poetry and gave me a lot of freedom. However, it was the acting industry with its parties and fabulous people that definitely led me down a short stint of incredibly hedonistic, cocaine-fueled behavior. Yes.
Did you draw on that for your series, I May Destroy You, also?
I did, yes. Yeah.
When you look at that period of your life, what are your thoughts about it?
Hey, I think my thoughts are very similar to when Arabella takes all those drugs and somehow is escorted home very safely. I say, well, hey, you know, it's good that I'm safe and I'm healthy and I'm okay.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about what the differences may be between being African-American, between being black in America, where most black people in America have descendants who were brought here on slave ships, and people of African descent in England, because they were not brought there as slaves, but they were colonized by various European countries. And I'm just wondering if you've given a lot of thought about what the differences it might be, and if you have many black friends in America and have talked with them about some of the differences about what it means to be black in England versus America.
Yeah. Yes, I have, actually. I do have some black friends in America, and I think we find it fascinating and discuss these things quite a lot. There's an experience that I have here in Britain as a child of African immigrants that I think has similarities and differences. Obviously, my parents were not born here. Mother tongue is different. You know, I had not been to Ghana until 2018. I'd never been there. So there's no lineage to trace in the land that you know, Britain. But also when I go to Ghana, even the way I walk, you will know that I am not I'm not a Ghanaian born and raised in Ghana. So that exists. However, I think that beyond being sent there on slave ships, African Americans also can't trace their lineage. You know, what happens before that? Where did they come from on these slave ships? They aren't able to trace that either. So I think there is a similarity in that sense of being displaced. I do hear from some of my friends that in America, people like me who are British African are seen differently as people from who are African American. You know, perhaps there's a strange privilege being me in America that is denied to people who are African American. And I don't know whether it's because I don't share that history of slavery, being the descendants of slaves, you know, that African Americans do with people in America. We're not sure, but it's fascinating.
Do you think that people's attitudes sometimes change toward you once they hear your British accent?
Exactly that. Something about the accent, I think just Britain have done a very good job of perpetuating the narrative of being very fine and fancy and elegant. And I think this somehow enters the minds of Americans when they hear it, which it's interesting because it's not real. It's not real at all. It's all based on these stereotypes and prejudices. And, you know, I sometimes say, you know, I've dropped out of college 3 times, but my voice is giving you a different story. But also, I think, you know, I talk to a lot of my Black British friends, and especially the actors and creatives, your voice, perhaps this is also in America. I think this is in America, and actually beyond African Americans, I think this is for people who are born into working class homes, that to progress in your field, you have to change your voice. And it's not that conscious, but my voice has changed so much, as have my peers who are also from working class backgrounds and Black, that we sometimes wonder, I wonder, why can't I sound like the person that I was? It's interesting, we change and we refine our voices, and I've never seen anybody who is Black and working class and British further themselves in their careers without having to change their voice.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's just been a pleasure to talk with you, and congratulations on the series.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Michaela Cole created, wrote, directed, and stars in the HBO series I May Destroy You. The English writer Zadie Smith is best known for novels such as White Teeth and Swing Time, and she's widely admired for her nonfiction. In her new book, Intimations, 6 Essays, which will be published Tuesday, Smith writes about what's been going on over the last few months. Our critic at large, John Power, says it's a book as bracingly deep as it is refreshingly slim.
Fiction writers spend much of their lives creating made-up worlds, which may be why they can't resist writing about the real one. Yet when they do weigh in on current events, like the pandemic, or the racial reckoning triggered by the George Floyd killing, they are often eloquent, but rarely say anything new or valuable. There are, of course, exceptions. Over the years, I've read and reread Grace Paley and James Baldwin and never failed to learn from them, whether they were writing about Vietnam, racism, or feminism. Even when I disagreed, I trusted them because they were principled, yet open to the many-sidedness of experience. They were voices of wisdom. A current writer I trust is Zadie Smith. And before going any further, I should add that when she first hit big 20 years ago with her debut novel, White Teeth, I was officially a Zadie skeptic. not because of anything she'd done. White Teeth is a terrific first novel. But because, as a mixed-race London woman in her early 20s, Smith too perfectly fit the media's need for a writer who could embody the fantasy of a fun, attractive, multicultural new millennium. In fact, I was totally wrong. Smith herself seemed to rebel against the cultural role she'd been assigned, and these days I find in her work what I once found in Paley and Baldwin, a clarifying lucidity wedded to big-hearted moral awareness. These virtues shine through her powerful new collection, Intimations, 6 essays, which she began at the onset of the pandemic and finished shortly after Floyd's killing. Although only 100 pages, it made me think more than most books 5 times that length. There's something worth quoting on virtually every page. As its title intimates, Intimations isn't a tome with a grand thesis. Instead, Smith presents a series of elegant short essays about living with, and maybe resisting, what we're going through right now. In The American Exception, she begins with President Trump saying that he wishes we could have our old life back, when we had a great economy and, quote, we didn't have death, unquote. She doesn't cite this to bash him. Heck, I wanted that too. But to reflect on everything from our desire to turn back the clock to our nation's inegalitarian health care. Death comes to all, she notes wryly, but in America, it has always been considered reasonable to offer the best chance of delay to the highest bidder. The essay Something to Do addresses an issue that many of us have faced during the lockdown. How do we fill our time? Smith uses the idea of obsessive doing, the endless baking of banana bread, for instance, to touch on Puritan ideas of achievement, middle-class anxiety about self-improvement, and in a brilliant pivot, the hollowness of mere doing compared to the fullness of loving. In another essay, she invokes the idea of social privilege, yet doesn't use it punitively to diminish other people's pain. Suffering, she writes, has an absolute relation to the suffering individual. It cannot easily be mediated by a third term like privilege. If it could, the CEO's daughter would never starve herself, nor the movie idol ever put a bullet in his own brain. Smith is interested in people as well as ideas, and in the chapter called Screen Grabs, she tells us about the hoverboarding tech guy from work, whose devotion to style reveals a social truth. For many young adults, style is all they have as a counterweight to economic insecurity and untenable debt. In the most devastating of these grabs, Smith examines the look on the face of the officer who killed George Floyd and explains why she dislikes the label hate crimes. The term reinforces the perpetrator's belief that the slaughter of, say, innocent churchgoers possesses a special, almost philosophical grandeur. Smith has a mind that I just love watching work, and I could go on and on discussing the great bits in this slim volume. From her analysis of how Zooming leads us to aestheticize our conversations, to the book's quietly galvanizing final line. As she hopscotches from the personal to the political, the topical to the eternal, Intimations begins with a discussion of peonies. Smith does more than illuminate what we're going through right now. She offers a model of how to think ourselves through a fraught historical moment without getting hysterical or sanctimonious, without losing our compassion or our appreciation for what's good in other people. She teaches us how to be better at being human.
My guest, Jim McCluskey, is part detective, part man of God. While studying at Princeton Theological Seminary, planning to become an ordained minister, he did field work at a prison. There he met a man serving a life sentence for murder, a man who convinced McCluskey he was innocent. McCluskey took a leave from Princeton to work on this case and somehow succeeded, although he had no legal background. It led McCluskey to found one of the first innocence projects, Centurion Ministries, dedicated to reopening the cases of men and women unjustly convicted of murder. John Grisham calls McCluskey the dean of all innocence advocates, the exonerator. In McCluskey's new memoir, When Truth is All You Have, he writes about his life, the cases he's taken on, and how his faith in God was sometimes challenged, and how his faith in the justice system was shaken by police who lied on the witness stand, prosecutors who knew, and judges who turned a blind eye to the whole thing. Jim McCluskey is now retired, but still serving on the board of Centurion Ministries and still working on cases. He's a lay minister. Jim McCluskey, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is such a great pleasure to talk with you again, and I love your new memoir.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's great to be here. I'm happy to have returned.
So you were very religious as a child, and then you headed in the opposite direction. You became kind of wild. You served in the military. You had a good-paying job at a consulting company. So you went through these different phases of your life, but then you decided to go to Princeton Theological Seminary in around 1980. Why did you make that shift in your life?
Well, you know, I was 37 years old, and I had been in Japan in business for a number of years. And when I came back to the United States and began working for a Philadelphia consulting company by the name of Hay Associates, and things were going well there. But throughout the 1970s, when I was in my 30s, I became disillusioned with the business world, my place in it. I didn't find the work to be fulfilling. I didn't feel as if I was leading a real authentic life. I wasn't serving anyone other than the corporation and myself. And I went back to church for the first time in 14, 15 years. And I went to Paoli Presbyterian Church. And I really was impressed with our minister, Dick Streeter. It was a large suburban congregation. He was really touching the hearts and the souls of his congregants. And I looked at myself, and I wasn't touching the heart and soul of anybody, really. And I also, at the same time, became very serious and took a deep dive into the scriptures. And the next thing I knew, I was feeling a call to leave the business world and go into the ministry so that I, too, could serve the interest of others in a real significant fashion and maybe help change lives, like Dick Streeter was changing my life. So I decided to go to the seminary, give up the business world, and go to the seminary and become an ordained Presbyterian church pastor.
That's not exactly what happened, though, because you took a detour. For your field work, you asked to be placed at a prison. You became a prison chaplain, and there you met the first person who led you to do innocence work. And he told you he had done bad things, but that he hadn't committed murder. He was convicted when he was 28 and was serving a life sentence. Why did you believe him? Because a lot of people say everyone in prison will tell you that they're innocent.
Well, I'd like to put that canard to rest. That's not true, in my experience, anyhow. When I was a student chaplain in Trenton State Prison and met Jorge de los Santos for the first time, there were 40 inmates, and each of them in their respective cells. So I was ministering, if you will, to 40 different inmates, and only two were claiming to be innocent. To my surprise, a number of them were telling me what they did. So most people, in my experience, don't say they're innocent, although somehow that has come to be believed by almost everybody. But anyway, Jorge, his nickname was Chiefy, C-H-I-E-F-I-E, and as soon as I met Mr. De Los Santos as a student chaplain standing before his cell, he claimed to be an innocent man of murder, and I didn't believe that. I thought, come on, that doesn't happen in America. We have the best criminal justice system there can be. And if there are any innocent people in prison, it's certainly an aberration and an isolated case. But there he was every time I would come by his cell and we would chat. All he would talk about was his innocence, and he didn't do it. And over the course of several months, I came to be provoked by his cries of innocence, thinking to myself, could this really be? Is he what he says he is, an innocent man? And then it started from there.
And he told you that he believed in God, but if God was going to help free him, it would have to be through you. And you seem to take that very seriously.
Well, here's what happened. You know, I started the student chaplaincy work in September of 1980, and by Thanksgiving of that year, I was provoked by his cries of innocence. So I got hold of his trial transcripts, a lot of documents about the case, some 2,000 pages, and that's what I did over the Thanksgiving holidays. I read all the transcripts. So now I had the state's case, and I had his viewpoint of his conviction, how wrong it was. So I asked him a ton of questions, and over time, you know, I have to say that I was provoked. He was convicted based on what was a obviously, even in my lay experience, an unreliable eyewitness account, plus a jailhouse confession where a career criminal had told Mr. De Los Santos' jury that the defendant confessed to him while they were in the county jail. Finally, when I came back from Thanksgiving and he said, did you read the transcripts? And I said, yes, they did. And he said, is there anything that I've told you that's not true? I said, no. He said, you've asked me a million questions over the last several months about my case. Now, I want to ask you a question. And I said, oh, boy, I wonder what this is going to be. So he said, do you believe I'm innocent? And I said, yes, I do believe you're innocent. He said, well, what are you going to do about it? I said, what do you mean, what am I going to do about it? I don't know. I mean, there's nothing. What can I do, Chiefy? I've never had any experience of in the criminal justice system at all. I'm just a seminary student down the road here. He said, well, I've been praying for 6 years for God to send somebody to free me. You might not realize it, but you're that man. You're my angel to free me out from under this false conviction. I need you, and God has chosen you to be that man. Then he really challenged me. He said, what are you going to do? Are you going to go back to your nice, safe, secure little seminary and just pray for me? I said, well, that's what I was thinking about doing. he said, that's not going to work. If you're a real man of faith, you're going to come save me. And that's all there is to it. I have nobody else but you. Well, he got me to thinking. I went back to my safe little secure seminary and did pray and think about it. And then I decided that, you know, I think I have to do this. I have to take a year off from school and work to see what I can move the ball forward to try and free him.
Yeah, and you succeeded, which is really remarkable. One of the turning points was that a key witness confessed to you that his testimony was a lie. Tell us why he confessed and what he confessed to.
Well, his name was Richard Della Sante, which in Italian means of the saints. And coincidentally, Chiefy's last name was De Los Santos, which in Spanish means of the saints. And I will say this, that neither of the two were saints. But Chiefy was, in my view, was not a killer. He was a heroin addict on the streets of Newark. But Richard De Los Santos had also, I learned later through my investigation, that he was a longtime informant for the Essex County Prosecutor's Office up in Newark, New Jersey. They would use him in a number of cases to come in and give some incriminating testimony, false testimony, about a defendant. One of those was his own first cousin, Danny De Los Santos. He testified against his own first cousin and falsely said that Danny confessed that murder to him. So I went to the De Los Santos family, and long story short, they introduced me to Richard. They kept asking Richard to please talk to Mr. McCluskey. If he's successful for Mr. De Los Santos, that will help Danny get freed. So it took a year until finally I got a telephone call out of the blue from Richard De Los Santos, and he said, I know who you are. I know what you're doing. If you want to talk to me, I'm ready to talk to you. And when I visited him for two straight days, hours per day up at the Hudson County Jail in Jersey City, the reason he told me that he's finally coming forward and telling the truth, he said, I'm just tired of living a lie. I'm tired of being the pinch hitter for the Essex County Prosecutor's Office. They've been running my life for 10 years, and I'm tired of it. And now all I want to do is tell the truth and get this off my conscience.
Did the prosecutor know that he was giving false testimony?
There's no question that he did. At Mr. De Los Santos' trial, under direct examination by the trial prosecutor, the prosecutor asked Richard De Los Santos, have you ever informed in any other case? Are you an informant? And Richard said, no, I'm not an informant. This is the first time I've done this. All the while, the prosecutor knew that that was a lie, because prior to the post-conviction evidentiary hearing, years later, we got access to the prosecutor's files, and there in the hand, the actual handwritten notes of the trial prosecutor, was the statement to Richard DeLisante, in habit of giving testimony. So we proved, and to the federal district judge's satisfaction as well, in his opinion, that freed and exonerated Mr. De Los Santos, federal district judge Frederick Lacey stated that the prosecutor knew that De Los Santos was an informant and had suborned perjury.
What an introduction to the justice system you had. False testimony by somebody who was like a pro at it, and then a prosecutor who was in on it and who knew about it, and a man serving a life sentence as a result of it. You must have just had this immediate cynicism after that experience.
Yes, I was starting to mature. I was starting to see the system with different eyes than when I first met Chiefy 2.5 years earlier. And I got a baptism of fire. I saw firsthand how police and prosecutors manipulate evidence, coerce witnesses into giving false testimony. You know, it was a stunner, and I started to really rethink my whole position on the integrity of police and prosecutors.
There must be such highs and lows in the work that you've done over the past 40 years. I mean, when you succeed in freeing a man or woman who is unjustly convicted, that must be such an exhilarating feeling. But on the other hand, even when you succeed in freeing somebody, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have a good life when they get out. It's so hard for many prisoners to make the transition back into life. I mean, you're coming to the outside world with, like, no money. You don't know what's been going on in the world because you haven't been living in it. You've been living in a cell for so long. And the first case that you took, the case that inspired you to do this work for 40 years, Jorge De Los Santos, you succeeded in getting him exonerated. But then he had a very hard time when he got out of prison. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, well, what happened with Mr. De Los Santos, tragically, was that when we freed him in the summer of 83, within 2 years, he was back using drugs heavily, descended into his addiction again, which led him to commit crimes. He robbed some drug user, as he had done before I met him. And he ended up doing another 8 or 9 years in New Jersey state prisons as a result. By that time, we had faded from each other. He was so ashamed of how he led his life subsequent to us exonerating him that he just, I lost complete contact with him. He just felt so ashamed. He didn't want to talk to me because he knew what had transpired in his life. Anyway, he was found in a vacant lot in Brooklyn, murdered, beat to death. The supposition being that a drug buy went bad, and there he was. But let me say this about that, if I may, Terry. I still thank God for bringing him into my life, because were it not for that Newark-raised public housing project of Puerto Rican descent, who was a heroin addict, were it not for him, there would be no Centurion Ministries. Not only would there be no Centurion Ministries, but I would have been lost in the world, because as I think back on it, I would not have been a good church pastor. That just wasn't in me, as it turns out. So he gave me new purpose, a new life, and I treasure that new life. And I thank God for Jorge De Los Santos. So, and a point can be made that maybe the other 62 people that we freed might still be languishing in prison. And so I owe my life to that man. We gave him new life, and he chose to go in a different direction. And I don't hold that against him, because he just couldn't beat the drugs.
I think the fate of Jorge De Los Santos made you realize that you had to keep in touch with people after they were freed, people who you had helped to free, and help them establish their life outside of prison. So that's a whole other aspect of the work that you've done. You even had one of the people who you helped exonerate live with you for a while.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. Based on our experience with Mr. De Los Santos, we realized that we had another responsibility that we were originally unaware of, not only freeing these people, but working with them to help them regain their lives and reintegrate back into society after many, many years of wrongful incarceration. So that has become a major part of our work over the years. And that also, by the way, you think there's stress with trying to free innocent people from prison and get them out. There's a lot of stress attendant with these very personal situations of doing our best to work with those we free to make sure that do we do what we can to be their friends, not just their advocates, but their friends and their support system, at least part of their support system, as they go about regaining their lives.
Jim, it's been so great to talk with you again. Congratulations on your memoir and all the work you've done in the last 40 years. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you again.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. I really enjoyed once again talking with you, and you always ask great questions and you get down deep, and I appreciate that very much, so thank you.
Jim McCluskey is the founder of Centurion Ministries and author of the new memoir, When Truth Is All You Have.